Season 2 of Love in Context podcast welcomes you. Get ready for engaging, unscripted conversations with your hosts, Ben and Spencer. Our mission remains unchanged: to explore the Bible through the powerful lens of love.
In this new season, we'll embark on a journey together, unearthing fresh insights and gaining deeper understanding of how we can love God and live out our faith in practical ways.
So let's dive into this season of Love in Context, where love and the context of the Bible intersect to transform our lives.
Welcome to the Love in Context podcast. Today, we are going to be continuing in our Kings and Kingdoms series, and we are going to be talking about Ahasuerus, or as I like to say, Ahasuerus.
Yes, you nailed it. You nailed it. I think I've heard in the last 2 weeks you pronounce his name 55 different ways.
Yeah, I'm going for 60.
Yeah, so that's pretty great. Yeah.
Phonetically, it does not, it should be different than how we say it.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Phonetically, it just looks really weird.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm not even positive that I'm pronouncing it correctly. I just went off of how I heard somebody pronounce it. And I'm
you
like,
you all
yeah.
heard that. Ben is mispronouncing a word in the Bible.
There you go. But we've been in the King and Kingdom series. We've been talking about these non-Israelite kings and their impact on the story, mm-hmm. and also just like what we can learn from them as just individuals. Because a lot of times we have a tendency to focus on the biblical characters, which is a good reason to.
Yeah.
But there's a lot going on around them, and historically that the original readers of the text would have been pretty familiar mm-hmm. with that we are not.
Yes.
You know, so... just kind of taking a, like, before we get into the actual biblical narrative, we want to talk briefly about, okay, so who is King Ahasuerus, mm-hmm. right? How did he shape society? How did he shape culture? You know, things that we've been talking about over the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. So one of the first things we know is that he is the son of Darius I, mm-hmm. right? So he is the one who succeeds the guy we talked about last week.
Yep.
There's a few things that you remember from Darius that he had set up, like these provinces that called satraps, and mm-hmm. like there's all these regions that now come back and they have this conversation. Mm-hmm. But like he's overseeing all these people who are in charge of smaller regions, and it's kind of like a upwards authority chain, mm-hmm. right? So his reign was between 486 and 465 BCE, and it came before his son Artaxerxes. The first man, I was reading his name, and I was like, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this right. So just a reminder, like Darius had been pushing things forward. He made it a lot more free for religions, but there was one religion specifically that he was pushing. We're going to come back to that because his mm-hmm. son, not surprisingly, does a very similar thing.
Yeah.
And so let's just take a look here. So Ahasuerus is actually the name is only actually used in the Bible. The name Ahasuerus is actually literally translated in Hebrew as king. And it's one that's used in Ezra, it's used in Esther, and it's used in Daniel to refer to Persian kings, mm-hmm. specifically. Most scholars agree that the king in the time of Esther, though, was Xerxes I. So mm-hmm. if we say Xerxes I or we say Ahasuerus, we're talking about the same person, mm-hmm. right? By the way, this is very similar to how, in Torah and all throughout the Bible, like they talk about Pharaoh.
Yeah.
They don't talk about a specific pharaoh. They just use the ruler of Egypt is pharaoh, mm-hmm. right? So both in the time of when Joseph and his family go down to Egypt and the pharaoh when they're leaving Egypt, they're both just mm-hmm. pharaoh,
yeah,
right? Now, obviously, those are different people, but it's almost like the biblical account is like, hey, this is like a typecast of who's an authority here, mm-hmm. but the story's not about them,
yeah,
right? It's about somebody else. Mm-hmm. So he ruled during the height of the Persian Empire, overseeing its vast territories and diverse peoples. So a few places he's talked about in history. We've talked about this guy before, but he is Herodotus. I totally said that name right the first time.
It's Herodias.
No, that's definitely Herodotus.
You're Herodotus.
Look at
it. I've always pronounced it Herodias.
Well, let's take a look. Let's ask chat how to pronounce that. How do you pronounce Herodotus? Probably shouldn't actually say it that way for it to pronounce. Herodotus.
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 So we're both wrong.
Yep. So we're both wrong. We actually looked up the pronunciation. It's Herodotus. So Herodotus, he's known as one of the fathers of history. Mm-hmm. He's a 5th century Greek historian. He provides a comprehensive account of Xerxes I. Mm-hmm. Some of the key details of this was the invasion of Greece. He describes Xerxes' massive military campaign. Now, if you remember when we were talking about Darius I, one of the Persia's like defining features is that they have a lot of people.
Yeah.
A lot of people, overwhelmed, right? So in 480 BCE, it includes the battles of Thermopylae, Somalis, and Plataea. By the way, if anybody is a historian in any of these things and I'm saying the names wrong, just deal with it. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not the... Wow, flashlight.
I went to turn on Do Not Disturb, and I hit flashlight on
Perfect.
Accident.
I was like, man. And then, at Thermopylae, you actually may remember this story from a famous movie that they made. Xerxes' forces defeats a small coalition of Greek city-states led mm-hmm. by King Leonidas of Sparta. Mm-hmm. If you remember the movie 300, it is a retelling, mm-hmm. creative retelling probably,
yep.
of the story of Thermopylae. That the Greeks, the story becomes legendary about them. Just they slow down the Persians, and so they're not even, like everybody else behind them is able to get their act together before they get in there.
Yeah,
right. And he has another one. It's at Salamis. He suffered this massive, major defeat at the hands of the Greek fleet, forcing him to retreat. And this there's conversation about how this became like mm-hmm. the beginning of the end of Persia's like naval dominance, mm-hmm. right? There is a interesting thing he's really famous for with engineers. So if you're an engineer, throw on your engineer hat. At the Hellespont Bridge, he ordered the construction of these pontoon bridges and across the Hellespont. It's modern day called the Dardanelles.
We'll go with that, yeah.
Yeah, that looks right. Mm-hmm. So to actually transport his army into mm-hmm. Greece. And so it's like these temporary pontoons that they actually used to cross. And then when they actually crossed, it was like an engineering yeah. marvel because it was like a temporary bridge that he put into place. Mm-hmm. But most of Herodotus, I'm nailing these names today, man.
If you're expecting a child anytime soon, you can take any one of the translations
of those
two names we've messed up.
Yes, Osawaras, I would recommend uh-huh. that. That just like flows uh-huh. off the name. Flows off the name. Wow. It flows off the tongue. But especially like if you think about, like when you think about these names, you got to think about like if I had to yell at my child across the room, right? Shoes are us. Yeah, like this is probably not going to work right.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of Herodotus, mm-hmm. his details really emphasize Persian failures and Greek heroism. Not surprising yeah. because he's a Greek historian, mm-hmm. right? So his stories are going to be maybe exaggerate some of Xerxes' flaws.
So Ben decided to hand it over to me at the name of, are you guys ready for this? Aeschylus?
I'm taking it. It's a Greek tragedy writer, right?
Aeschylus.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds more like something that a sound you make when you sneeze.
Aeschylus.
Yeah.
So, full disclosure, I probably just butchered that, and we're going with it.
Yep.
So, in his play, he dramatizes his defeat at Somalis. From the perspective of the Persian court.
Yeah. And specifically it's mm-hmm. it's dramatizing and really puffing up Xerxes as yeah. a really proud individual.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That it's his pride that actually leads to the yeah. downfall of his army.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is I believe that the Persians, and it says 472 BCE mm-hmm. is when that's actually written.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy by the name of Ctesias of Cnidus. Man, these guys really liked these names. And he's a Greek physician who worked in the Persian court from 5th century BCE. So he wrote mm-hmm. a history of Persia. And his accounts of Xerxes are a lot less detailed than the others, yeah. but they offer some alternate perspectives, such as like court intrigue and Persian mm-hmm. culture. But unfortunately, like most of the manuscripts from like these times, most of it didn't survive. And so they have yeah. pieces. Yeah. They have pieces of it, and they have to kind of push it together.
Yeah.
But then a very familiar name, Josephus, right? He is one of the first century Jewish historians. He actually refers to Xerxes as Ahasuerus, as he's talking about the Book of Esther. That's actually a lot of reasons that we associate Xerxes with that time, as long as well as other historical evidence.
Yes. Yeah.
Other later Greek writers and Roman writers like Plutarch, by the way, naming kids, Diodorus. These are good names. Siriculus, they mention Xerxes in their broader histories of Persia, often highlighting their military campaign and then interaction with the Greeks. So he's pretty well documented in history, which is why they don't have any trouble placing him in the story of of Esther and of what was going on.
And we talked about that a few weeks ago, where the further we get in the series, the more documentation we're going to have.
Yeah, I think next week we're talking about Herod the Great, and there's literally more things to talk about than I have places to put them. It would be like a 4-hour episode, and then after that we're going to talk about Caesar Augustus. I don't even think we have time to record that, you know?
I don't know.
I definitely don't have time to edit it, especially with the way we're pronouncing names today. I just want to touch on a few inscriptions, archaeological things that are going on. So there's a bunch of inscriptions that were left talking about Xerxes at Persepolis. He also has dedicated inscriptions detailing his dedications to Zoroastrianism. Remember, we talked about that last week. The primary religion of his empire and his efforts to maintain order within it. So there's also some archaeological evidence that Xerxes went and destroyed temples and statues associated with local religions. Good examples are Babylon and Egypt as part of his attempt to center practice around Zoroastrianism. The Babylon Aeschylia Chronicle mentions Xerxes suppressing revolts in Babylon and potentially desecrating the temple of Marduk. That's actually really interesting. You should actually go read on that. That's about the worship of Marduk. You're going to find some really interesting connections into biblical narrative. Not our point today. We talked about the Helpon Bridge, the modern architecture, and how he shows up in both Babylonian and Egyptian records, specifically because both of those regions, he quelled rebellions.
Yes.
He brought in the army to quell rebellions. Now, remember, we talked about there's these satraps, and they're all in charge of these different regions. Great. But if they rebel, now you got to come in, and usually you're having to take out a few people because they combine together to try to rebel. So some key events of his reign is that he failed to invade Greece. Right, that's actually probably the most well known for Xerxes the First, in the Greco-Persian Wars. And most of you who've gone through history actually probably remember that from your world history classes. The Thermopylae and Salamis; those are, you know, the big examples. Give me 1 second. So with that, because of that, he actually failed to consolidate the Greek territories that he had actually inherited from his father, because his father had actually been defeated at Marathon in 490. And despite the immense amount of resources that Xerxes actually devotes to this conquering of Greece, just can't do it, right? He's not able to subjugate its city-states, leaving it largely independent. So it marks this turning point in the Greco-Persian Wars, shifting the balance of power toward the Greeks, right? So we're starting to see in the life of Ahasuerus, you're starting to see the decline of Persia, which is going to lead to the rise of Greece. Of course, then you're going to see the decline of Greece into the rise of Rome, right? If you're a student of history, you know what we're talking about.
Ahasuerus also, he did have some infrastructural achievements where he did maintain and expand the Persian Royal Road, which that was that network that we talked about where they could actually deliver messages faster than Amazon and get packages to Alaska.
Careful, Jeff Bezos is going to listen and get on us.
Well, I'm not wrong. So,
yeah, you're not wrong.
that's one of the achievements that he had. Was he was actually able to help maintain that and expand that. He also had some achievements as far as monumental status. He built colossal winged bulls at the gate of all nations, blending Mesopotamian and Persian styles, right? So he was doing this thing where he was trying to blend things together to be like, no, we are more so this act of unification to be like, we are one people, right?
Right. Which also focusing on multilingualism. That's a hard word. That is a difficult word. I'm picking hard words today.
We're doing great.
But taking all the languages and actually making sure that like all these languages are actually being understood throughout throughout the country.
Yeah.
The road systems is really important because one of the things we talked about in Darius with them developing this royal road system is that when Christianity shows up and Rome has now made all these roads everywhere because it's like it becomes a thing moving forward. It actually allows for the spread of Christianity at a rapid pace because of that. It's almost like God knows what his timing is doing.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
One of the things that's going to be important to the narrative today is he also consolidated the city to Susa, became his city that he reigns from.
Yep. Yep. So you get to this biblical narrative, right?
Yep.
That's where we are. So this, where you actually see the start of this is actually in Esther 1, verses 1 through 9, where it actually talks about Ahasuerus' wealth and power.
Yep.
Right? So this guy, and when they're describing it, and just to paraphrase it here real quick, when they're describing it, they're not describing like, oh yeah, he's semi-wealthy. They're not saying that. They're actually equating him to Jeff Bezos status.
Mm-hmm.
Like being like...
But we quoted him twice. We may get flagged.
And we might.
Yeah.
They're equating him to Elon Musk status. There we go. So use whichever one you want.
Yeah. Actually, if you look here, so I just want to point out a couple of things because we've already talked about historical context of Persia. Mm-hmm. Verse 1 of chapter 1 of Esther. This is what happened during the time of Ahasuerus, the Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes, I'm just going to use Xerxes because that's within the biblical translated English, even though it's actually Ahasuerus in Hebrew.
Yeah.
Reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa, and in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia, the princes, and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of the kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When those days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. Okay, so 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. He hosts a 180-day festival. Just this massive display of just like power, wealth, all these different things. So the question is, why is he doing this?
Yeah.
There's a book I'm going to recommend written by Rabbi David Foreman. It's called The Queen You Thought You Knew.
Mm-hmm.
He gets into some of the things going on in Ahasuerus, and we're just going to be like skimming a stone across the front. But it's a really good deep dive into into the book of Esther.
So to give you guys kind of an idea of the kingdom he ruled, this is according to a quick Google search.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It is about 6,827 kilometers to get from India to Ethiopia, which would equivalent to Kush.
Yeah.
Right? So that right there is actually bigger than the span that you would is actually a little bit bigger than the span from East Coast to West Coast in the United States.
Right. If you leave out Alaska.
If you leave out Alaska. Yeah. But so this kingdom that he's ruling is massive.
Yeah. And definitely bigger than anything they've seen up to this point. So there's 127 provinces. So we talked about these satraps, and we talked about these people who are in charge of these regions.
Yeah.
So he's got satraps, he's got princes, he's got people who like rule over regions.
Yeah.
He's got all these people at his place, and he's throwing a 180-day festival to show them the wealth, the power, the prestige of Persia. Why is that important?
180 days.
180 days. That's a lot. It's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of partying.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, he does a 7-day banquet in Susa for all the great and small people who are there. Now, why is he doing this? Because as the ruler of Persia, you need all these people on board with you, right? Because this is not Nebuchadnezzar. This is not I rule with an iron fist. You do what I say, or I chop your head off. Right.
Nope.
This is Darius the First. This is Xerxes the First. They are. Yes, they're all powerful. They're in charge of the entire region, but they actually need the support of their, I'm going to call them underlings. They need support of their underlings in order to actually move forward.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a big, big piece of understanding Ahasuerus throughout this story, right?
Yeah, and you need to also understand, you need to understand his personality a little bit, right? He is an ambitious and indulgent individual.
Correct.
Right? He's, I would go as far as say he's gluttonous.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, So he has this huge amount of ambition. He wants to show how great, powerful he is. He's not just going to do that by like, look at everything I have. He's like, I am so powerful. I can throw a 180-day party. We can be gluttons for half a year,
mm-hmm.
right? And then we'll party some more,
mm-hmm.
right? And we'll just be indulgent, gluttonous people. And this is how wealthy I am, how powerful I am. So with Asharas, you have this gluttonous personality. You have this prideful personality. You have this ambitious personality. Which, spoiler alert, eventually leads to the downfall of the Persian Empire.
Yeah, I want to read this actually from, because this is leading mm-hmm. into the next portion of yeah. where what happens at this banquet. Mm-hmm. It says in verse 10, so his wife, Queen Vashti, mm-hmm. was running a separate banquet at the same time for the women, because this is a very patriarchal culture. The women are going to be separate from the men. Also, after 180 days of dudes partying, you probably don't want to be around them anyways.
They probably smell.
Yeah, but it says in verse 10 of chapter 1, on the seventh day when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine.
Mm. Yeah. So he's drunk.
He commanded the seven eunuchs who served him. By the way, eunuchs are people who are not going to have, what's a good way to say that?
They can't have relations.
They can't have relations, so they're the good ones to go get your wife, mm-hmm. right? And then to bring before him Queen Vashti wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the peoples and noble, for she was lovely to look at. Now, first of all, the first thing I want to point out is that Persian queens held power but were expected to remain mm-hmm. in the royal harem and follow strict social norms. So her refusal to meet, it was already out of the norms
mm-hmm.
to call her out there to be at the party.
Yep.
It was already like questionable social mores, mm-hmm. right? There is some conversation in the Babylonian Talmud about whether or not, like, that they suggest that when he tells her to show up in a royal crown, the implication is the royal crown and nothing else.
Yeah.
Now, that is subjective, but it would also add to this level of outside of the social norms,
mm-hmm.
right? That he's trying to display what is his.
Mm-hmm.
And so her defiance in this place, even though it is outside of the social norms, her defiance is seen as a direct opposition to his power
mm-hmm.
and his authority. Now, why is he having this party? Because he's trying to get these people to rally behind him yep. in order for him to go to war, to take conquest, to take over more areas, to continue to push his influence mm-hmm. forward. And so he's already known for being impulsive, quick-tempered, and apparently 7 days into a wine high,
mm-hmm.
right? And then it says that his advisors play a key role in his decision making and suggest deposing Vashti to preserve his authority.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now this is important because it's already going to be apparent that Xerxes in this story is going to defer to a lot of the judgment of his advisors.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that going to be important? Well, we'll get there. But he listens to his advisors. He allows them to have input into his ears. And he makes decisions, rash, impertinent decisions that have big implications for his community.
Yep.
Because Vashti, when he married her, would have been for a political reason to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So having her taken out of the court, divorcing her, killing her, depending on how you read that, not going to be a good look for his reign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, it's going to cause problems. Yes, you're the most powerful person in the world, but you also have an entire country that needs to rally around you. And apparently, Vashti was pretty well thought of.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Persian decrees, because we're not Nebuchadnezzar, where he said one thing and then he's like, you know what? Actually, I'm changing my mind. We're going to do this. And he doesn't have the iron mm-hmm. fist, right? That when the Persian decrees are made, they're made irrevocable. We're going to see this later in Esther 8:8 mm-hmm. when we're at the end of the story. So when he makes his decree, it likely served as propaganda to reinforce his authority and also, to perpetuate this authority of man over woman
yes.
in their country as well, which mm-hmm. is not great.
So now you have, where Esther comes into the story, and this is, starting at Esther chapter 2.
And incidentally, my wife does like Esther's name. So in Hebrew, it's Hadassah. Mm-hmm. So if you are thinking about naming a little girl, Hadassah is a great name.
Mm-hmm. Hadassah Esther.
Yeah, Hadassah Esther.
Yeah, yeah. So if you have your Bible, go ahead and turn to it. Go to Esther 2, 1 through 18. I'm going to give an overview. Ben's probably going to read some verses out of there as well, okay? But so at this point, Ahasuerus starts looking for a new queen,
mm-hmm.
okay? And so his advisors, they're bringing beautiful women into the court
mm-hmm.
and being like, do any of these people please you? So again, this also says something about the society that they're living in, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is very patriarchal. So he's not, they're not being like, hey, this person has good education, this person knows a lot, this person speaks well. They're like, here's a bunch of hot babes. Which mm-hmm. one do you like?
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're not saying this is the right way to select a mate.
We're just saying this is the way culturally what's going on right now. Side note, we both disagree with that, mm-hmm. this method, but this is what's going on right now. Okay. So Esther was a Jewish woman who was raised by her cousin Mordecai. Okay. Another great name.
By the way, you can also tell which names we've said more often when we're reading the text. Like, because mm-hmm. Mordecai, we didn't even hesitate.
No.
Yeah. We're also not going to hesitate with Haman, you know?
Yeah. Right. So Esther, raised by Mordecai, is selected to become the new queen of Persia,
mm-hmm.
of the Persian Empire.
Yes, and the biggest thing to take away from this chapter, because mm-hmm. we're not actually going to spend a lot of time talking about Esther, mm-hmm. because even though it's a great story,
mm-hmm.
Queen You Thought You Knew, great book,
yeah,
right? But the biggest thing that's important to the way that the story plays out, and specifically we're talking about the king, is that nobody knows that she's a Jew except for Mordecai.
Yeah.
They have no idea where she comes from. Now, once again, you're like, oh, well, how could that even be the case? Well, because what Osweiler has been doing, though, but he's been mingling everybody together. He's taking away, like, identifying marks like mm-hmm. language, culture, yeah. Practices, all these different things that people are familiar with that identify themselves. Mm-hmm. They're actually becoming more of a melting pot. Right. Yeah. So it's not going to be a normal thing. Like, you're not going to see a young Jewish girl in exile and necessarily think, oh, Jewish, because of the way that they dress and because of their practices and mm-hmm. things, because it's just not going to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really important, because then we come into chapter 3 and there's this guy by the name of Haman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Haman is an Agagite. So who is an Agagite? Do you know where they come from?
I actually don't.
They come from the Amalekites,
mm-hmm.
Who were a thorn in the side of the ancient Israelites. Now, if you remember back to Exodus 17, when we were having this story about this desert-dwelling, raiding people, like I call them like the desert people, the sand people, but from Star Wars, but they're, you know.
Tusken Raiders.
The Tusken Raiders, thank you.
I knew that one.
You know, it's Tusken Raiders. They're like the Tusken Raiders. They're out in the middle of the desert, and they tend to pick on these clans, and specifically, mm-hmm. they go and attack the weakest portion of the clan.
Yes.
So the Amalekites were known to be desert raiders, and they would always go after the weakest people in your place. So they're usually the people who are straggling on the back.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, that's why God instructs the biggest tribe to go in front, and the second biggest tribe
in the back. Mm-hmm.
Because you always keep your weak in the middle,
mm-hmm.
because they're meant to be protected.
Mm-hmm.
So that's who they are. And then they also talk about them in 1 Samuel 15. There's just a history of hostility toward the Jewish people. So if you're reading this book and you're a Jew and you say Haman the Agagite, and they go, there's an Agagite. That's not good.
And they're like, no.
Yeah. Agagite actually connecting to King Agag, right?
Agag. Yes.
So he's a huge deal, and so he gets promoted by Ahasuerus,
mm-hmm.
Probably because, you know, he's descendant of a king. He's probably got authority. He's got some mm-hmm. influence in the region, but he gets elevated for some reason, to the point that he actually starts asking people to bow down in his presence. Mm-hmm. He says, bowing in the Persian court culture would have been submission to the Persian court. So Mordecai's refusal. Sorry, I was trying to get ahead of myself. He tells everybody they have to bow down in his presence, but there's this guy by the name of Mordecai, who we've heard about already.
Mm-hmm.
He's the uncle of Esther, who just won't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a problem for Mordecai, because if you don't bow when you're supposed to, it's seen as an affront to the Persian court.
Side note, in Esther, in this part of the story, it doesn't specifically say why Mordecai doesn't bow.
Correct.
Right? It's likely because of religious reasons.
Yeah.
Likely because of his faith in God.
Like, it might be because he knew he's an Agite.
Yeah.
Right?
Right? We don't know. I've heard people preach on this, and they immediately jump to it's because he was a faithful man of God. And we're like, we actually don't know that.
Yeah.
We don't know that. All we know is that he didn't bow.
Right. So Haman is not mm-hmm. thrilled about it, because if you give somebody a little bit of power, then they're going to corrupt that power absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes to Ahasuerus, and he makes a statement. He says that the Jews are following completely separate laws. That's a big deal in this culture where everybody's supposed to be following a standard law, mm-hmm. right? And they're exploiting fears of disloyalty in this diverse Persian population. They're trying to take away from what you're trying to do, Xerxes. You're trying to take away from who you're trying to become.
Yeah. they're essentially he's spreading this lie, being like they're trying to revolt.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, in earlier in our episode, we talked about how Oshawara's actually put down revolts.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he's going to be kind of sensitive to that, mm-hmm. right? So then the king, in a typical move, because he tends to just do whatever his advisors tell him to do, mm-hmm. approves Haman's plan without investigating it at all.
Mm-hmm.
He's just like, yep, sounds good to me. Here we go. Let's go and eliminate the Jews. No investigation. And so he's completely detached from the responsibility of kingship,
mm-hmm.
right? Because if something's being brought here, like you're going to go put it on a rebellion of an entire people, yeah. you should probably make sure that those reports are true mm-hmm. before you go and do that.
And at this point, you have Esther,
mm-hmm.
who then goes before the king at the potential penalty of death for mm-hmm. going before the king uninvited to be like, hey, I'm a Jew, and the rest of the Jews, we're not trying to do this.
Mm-hmm.
We're not trying to revolt. We're not trying to uprise, and pleads for their lives. Right now, she does this at the risk of her own life. Okay, and Esther and Ahasuerus extends his golden scepter, sparing her life.
Mm-hmm.
So he shows mercy. And then he offers up half of her kingdom, and she invites
half of her kingdom.
No, he offers up half of his kingdom, and she invites him. Invites him and Haman to a banquet.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy because you think that, like, if you were Esther, mm-hmm. right, at this point, and he yeah. offers you up to half his kingdom, you're like, hey, can you just not kill the Jews?
Yeah, right.
Right? That'd be cool.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, still neither Haman nor Ahasuerus know that she's a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
So she invites the king and Haman to a dinner. Now, one of the things I think that Rabbi David Foreman does a really good job of kind of unpacking here in the language is she's building a lot of tension between Ahasuerus and Haman.
Yeah.
So imagine if you're like your spouse comes in and you're super happy with them and you're like, man, just I love you so much. I'll give you whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, let's have dinner with this person and us.
Mm-hmm.
What? Like, what? And then they have dinner, and then it comes to the end of the day, and you're like, man, I love you so much. Like, you can have whatever you want. They're like, can we have another dinner
mm-hmm.
with us and this person?
Mm-hmm.
And so it says that Ahasuerus has trouble sleeping in chapter 6.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder why.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder why he's having trouble sleeping.
Yeah.
Right? It's not the fact that his queen, that he's very enamored with, keeps inviting this guy, extra guy, over to the meal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing to do with that, right? He finds out that Mordecai had earlier in the story uncovered a plot to assassinate him. And so he calls in Haman. And he's like, hey, what should I do for somebody that the king really loves? Now, Haman, being very proud of himself
mm-hmm.
and being like, man, I'm super famous. Like, I'm going to dinners with the king and the queen and not realizing that there's probably a freight train coming at that light mm-hmm. at the end of the tunnel, right? He's like, well, you should probably put your royal robe on him and let him ride your horse through town, and people should sing his praises, talking about how great he is. He's like, great. So you know Mordecai,
uh-huh.
you know Mordecai, that guy. So he saved my life. We should do that for him.
Mm-hmm.
So as you can imagine, Haman's not super excited,
mm-hmm.
right? And then they come to the second banquet, and Esther actually reveals this plot, and Ahasuerus leaves the dinner to go walk about. I can't remember exactly why he goes out. I could actually look in the text, but he steps out, and Haman pleads for his life, but it says that he actually falls on Esther, and then Ahasuerus comes back in to see Haman all over Esther,
mm-hmm.
and then goes and executes him.
Mm-hmm.
Read the story. Read the queen you thought you knew. It's going to be very difficult for you to see anything else happening in this text than the fact that there's a very proud, powerful person
yeah.
who acts rashly, and that there's a situation being yeah. set up here,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, and so Haman is actually deposed. He's then executed by Ahasuerus. That's actually not where the story ends.
Nope.
And I think a lot of people think that's where the story ends,
mm-hmm.
because then she comes back to him and she's like, "Hey, can we not kill the Jews now?"
Mm-hmm.
But he's like, "I'm not going to. You can't revoke a decree."
Yeah.
It's a decree that's already gone out.
Mm-hmm.
And so what ends up happening is that that Mordecai and Esther, they come up with a decree that he's also going to issue that allows the Jews essentially to defend themselves and to even attack back and take from the other people if they're aggressed upon.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't actually reverse the decree. They give another decree that allows them to act in response to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting when you're looking at this story of Ahasuerus is that we're like, oh, well, just take back your decree. But that's not how Persians work. And he's also a very proud guy. He's a very mm-hmm. stuck on himself. And like, honestly, it probably doesn't matter to him mm-hmm. that much that the Jews would be eliminated.
So, I mean, up to this point in history, just in general, admitting you were wrong, even especially when you're in the place of being like a leader of mm-hmm. a country, of a nation, of an empire, it was something you did not do.
Yeah.
Right? You actually see that in Ahasuerus' father too, Darius,
mm-hmm.
when he realized he was wrong about the decree he made that put Daniel in the lion's den, mm-hmm. he didn't reverse it, right?
Right.
Because he's like, I can't do that because
once I make the decree, it's set
in stone. Like that's a cultural thing that's going on, not there, also in Babylon, also happens in Egypt. So just around the world, it's actually a common culture thing at the time.
You know, the interesting thing about that is, so Darius is deceived by his trusted advisors. Mm-hmm. And once again, here we have Haman, the Agagite, coming in and giving Xerxes, Ahasuerus, bad advice.
Mm-hmm.
That is ultimately not going to be well for his yeah. kingdom. There is this thing that sometimes generationally, father to son to father, like we start to see repeats of the same mm-hmm. pattern. We saw that in Genesis with like Abraham mm-hmm. to Isaac, Isaac to Jacob, Jacob yeah. to Joseph, right?
Yeah.
That there's a lot of like these repeats of the mm-hmm. same character. So you start getting into this thing of like, are you going to learn from the mistakes of your past or mm-hmm. are you going to just be doomed to repeat them?
Yeah.
I think the invitation is to be different.
Mm-hmm.
Right? To understand your past so that it can inform your future.
Yeah.
One of the things we talk about in churches is, and I think this has taken on different places depending on the way that you practice faith,
mm-hmm.
right? But when we talk about generational curses, we're talking about things that are in people's lives that show up generation to generation to generation to generation. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that God spoke to me a few years ago about is that there are things in my life, like my parents were good, mm-hmm. right? So I'm gonna stress that, like my parents did a good job mm-hmm. with me, but they weren't perfect. Mm-hmm. I'm doing a good job with my son, but I'm not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So what I try to do is I try to take the things that I know were wrong,
mm-hmm.
and I try to do them different.
Yeah.
And I try to do them better for the next generation.
Yeah.
And I'll make my own mistakes. I'll make my own. But my hope would be is that my son then, when he has kids,
mm-hmm.
is a better father than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And that his son is a better father than he is.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And in the church, I think a lot of times we have this mentality when we're raising up the generation after us.
Yeah.
That we're like, oh, well, they don't know. They're not going to be able. I was like, mm-hmm. but we want the next generation to be better than us.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if the next generation was better at loving God and loving other people, yeah. better at spreading grace and mercy,
yeah.
better at living in truth but standing in the middle of the world,
right?
Right. Better at being generous, mm-hmm. better at laying themselves down on behalf of other people.
Yeah.
And we did that generation to generation. So like our kids are, let's just say 14% better than us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And their kids are 20% better than them.
Yeah.
And their kids are 25% better than them. I was like, you know what you eventually get is...
Mm-hmm.
heaven on earth,
mm-hmm.
literally, because the kingdom of heaven is actually the very yeah. domain that we walk in.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. So there's a few key takeaways, I think, from this passage.
Mm-hmm.
One is the danger of being impulsive.
Mm-hmm. It right? gets him in a lot of trouble.
Right? And not just him, but Darius as well. You saw that some with Darius's life as well.
Yeah.
But this idea of being impulsive, of like, I'm just going to make rash decisions. It actually ends up getting him to where he, in his decrees, is actually creating conflicting decrees. One saying Jews have to be eliminated. He's like, actually, I can't take that away, but Jews, you can actually defend yourself now.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Which, by the way, if you have 127 providences that are receiving both those instructions, it's very confusing.
Uh-huh.
Yep. Right?
So he's made some decrees that if they went out, people would be like, something's happening somewhere, and I'm not sure what's going on.
Yeah.
But and then it leads people to be like, well, I can legally try to beat that Jew up, but they can fight back. They can legally fight back.
One of the things that people have, if you've been on the podcast for a while, you remember the episode we had with Ed McDowell on here.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to use him as an example. Ed McDowell is a very thoughtful person.
Uh-huh.
When you ask questions, he pauses for a second.
Uh-huh.
And then he answers slowly and, like, builds his, like, statement. Oh, like, because he's not in a hurry to respond.
Yeah.
He's not impulsive. Like, he's like, hey, let me actually think about, like, how to answer this in terms of, like, what I actually think.
Yeah.
Right? And there's a lot of wisdom in that, because when you live an impulsive lifestyle, you think about the things that he did impulsively. He eliminates Vashti impulsively, right? So now he has a power vacuum at a queen. So then he has to go and find a new queen. And then he gets an executive request from Haman, and he's like, "Sure, just eliminate these people. I believe you."
Mm-hmm.
Like. You need to take a pause and say, okay, Haman, let's talk about that. Can you give me some examples?
And then he realizes that his wife is one of those people.
Yep.
And doesn't reverse it, but is like, okay, well, I can't take the other one away, but your people can now fight back.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and mostly he just says, you guys can figure that you can issue a decree and I'll stamp it.
Yeah.
Right? So Esther and Mordecai actually have to come up with the decree.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just rubber stamps it, which, by the way, is what got him in this situation to begin with, right?
Yeah.
Like letting other people rubber stamp things for him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that impulsiveness, I think, goes with the second takeaway, which is there's a ton of consequences of having pride and power.
Yes.
Right? Like those two things will cause you to also act impulsively and usually to abuse it.
Which, by the way, those two things should never go together.
Pride and power?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, if you are someone who is in place of power, you actually need to be living a life of humility, because that's actually going to allow you to be more generous. That's going to allow you to see the brokenness around you, the hurting around you, and be able to take action.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When we live in a place where we're like, look how good I am, and you are living in a place of power, what ends up happening is you end up being like, I am better than anybody else in this room, anybody else in this town, and guess what? I know it, you know it, so get over it. And then you end up belittling people and doing the opposite of what Christ calls us to.
Absolutely. I was just thinking that when I edit this for like a social media clip, I could literally clip you just saying that. You're like, I'm the best. I'm the all there.
Oh, you're going to do it and send it to a few people.
Yeah, send it. I'll send it to your parents. I'll be like, hey, just so you know what Spencer said on the podcast.
And I will text them and be like, Ben's pulling this out of context. It's out of context.
It'd be a love and out of context.
Mm-hmm. So, like, but this idea is it's the opposite of being prideful and powerful is the opposite of what Jesus teaches. Mm-hmm.
In fact, actually, what Jesus tells us is that it's actually going to be important for us to have justice, but also accountability.
Yes.
Right? So we're not, even when we have power, we should have accountability.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. I'm always hesitant. Like, I think it's completely fine if a church has a pastor who makes the large bulk of their decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's crazy to me if they don't have a church board, elder board, deacon board, somebody who's going to come alongside the pastor and be like, hey, have you thought about this?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even in your case with Young Life, you have a committee who, like, if you're like, hey, I'm thinking about this, what do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And sometimes we go, that's great. And sometimes we're like, well, hold on. Maybe this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because... it's not because we think you're going to abuse your power, but it's to make sure that you always are seeing all angles of things, because you're not going to be able to.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well, it's accountability structure.
It's accountability structure.
Right? Because this is the other thing. Accountability, power without accountability leads to pride.
Yeah.
And so, like, you have to have that. And so whenever...
You might even say it leads to tyranny.
Yeah. Yeah. So you absolutely have to have accountability when you're in your leadership. Like in leadership roles.
Yeah.
And then the other one is a call to courage and advocacy.
Yeah, and this is really more of Esther,
but
it's in the story of Ahasuerus.
Mm-hmm. Esther had a huge amount of courage to be like, hey, I'm going to go to the king at the risk of my own life to see if he will spare my people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Huge amount of courage. Right? And the other thing is what is she having courage for?
Mm-hmm.
She's having courage for her people. She's advocating for people that currently don't have a voice and are about to undergo massive persecution.
Mm-hmm.
Right. This actually ties over to Matthew 25, where when Jesus is separating out sheep and the goats, he lists these things, and the sheep are like, "Yes, we saw." He's like, "Sheep, you saw that, you acted." The goats are like, "Well, when did we see you naked? When did we see you hungry? When did we see you in prison?" And Jesus says, "When you did this to the least of these, when you saw the least of these," right? Mm-hmm. And so we have this call as Christians to be advocates in our community. Now, I want to preface, we should preface this a little bit, though, because sometimes when people are advocates, they go about it the wrong way.
Yeah. Advocacy does not mean that you go around swinging hammers at people.
Yes.
That's actually construction work.
Uh-huh.
That's a completely different field.
If you have anger management issues, you know, demo work with a sledgehammer is great.
Yep.
It doesn't mean that you, because a lot of times we can become advocates at the belittlement of other people who also need to be advocated for.
Yeah. So. One little piece I want to throw in here. We weren't spending a lot of time talking mm-hmm. about Esther, but I think it's important when we're talking about this advocacy role. When Mordecai comes to Esther, mm-hmm. he makes a bunch of different statements, and I'm not going to get into it because it's in the book, and it's also in some teachings by Rabbi David Foreman, but there is a contextual link to a story mm-hmm. in the book of Numbers. Mm-hmm. I believe it's the book of Numbers. I might be misquoting the book, but it's the story of when a husband is able to override a wife's vow, right? And I think we talked about this briefly when we were in Torah. But essentially, the conversation that Mordecai has coming in with Esther is he says, he quotes from this chapter, because there's not three choices. There's not you can speak up, say nothing, or silently align.
Yeah.
That if you silently align, you're essentially saying that what they're doing is okay.
Yeah.
Okay? Being quiet is not a third choice.
Mm-hmm.
It's choosing to align yourself with what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean that you're going to, like we were saying, take a hammer and start throwing it at people. But if you mm-hmm. don't speak up and you don't make a statement about injustice, you don't do something with your life to stand against it,
yeah,
then essentially you're saying the injustice is okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, there is no third choice. You're either for the injustice or you're against the injustice. And I'm not, what, like, to your point, is that advocacy doesn't mean that you start, throwing fists,
mm-hmm.
right?
You don't put out a fire by starting a fire in another location.
Correct.
Right.
But if you also are just like, this is fine,
mm-hmm.
or I'm just not going to say anything about a fire.
So
if I'm driving down the road
yeah.
and I see a house on fire and I don't call 911,
mm-hmm.
my choice was not to be silent and that I was not in favor of the fire. It means that I was taking an active role in not suppressing the fire.
Mm-hmm.
I had an option to stand up and to do what was right, and I chose not to.
Yeah, so I have a friend, he describes advocacy this way, where he's like, a lot of times when we are being advocates, we'll see a fire in one spot, and then we'll go start a fire somewhere else, and we'll be like, but look how much worse that fire is.
Right.
And to that, he's like, what good did you just do? Now you have two fires.
Yeah.
Not one. Right? Like, if you want to put a fire out, you need to have something that puts fire out.
Yeah.
You need to have some water or some dirt or something like that, to where you can be like, okay, here is an issue, here's a problem. How can we come alongside and help address this?
Right.
Because if you're going to be an advocate, you need to be part of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you're going to try to be an advocate and make someone else part of the solution, that's not going to work, right?
Which, incidentally, that's exactly what Asawaris does,
uh-huh.
right? And and his reign doesn't last very long. I don't remember if you guys heard me at the beginning. His reign, we're only talking about 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty low amount of years for somebody in that kind of position.
Yeah, a lifetime appointment.
Yeah, a lifetime appointment. Like, it's pretty short term.
Yeah. But another way to think of advocacy real quick is, if I, let's say my car broke down and I went to Ben and said, you need to fix my car.
First of all, it would never get fixed.
No, it would not.
I would be like, are these tires? You're like, that's definitely a steering
Nick
wheel.
Nick is going to listen to this and he's going to be like, why would you ask Ben?
Yeah, he's like, why would you ask Ben to fix your car?
Right? Versus I could actually go to a shop and advocate for my car to be fixed.
Yeah.
Right? It might cost me some time, might cost me some money, right? But if I just went to Ben, and I was picking on Ben because Ben and I both know he doesn't know much about cars. Side note, Thanksgiving dinner, there's another friend there, and him and I were both talking cars, and Ben's over there. He's like, engines, wheels, yeah.
I was like, oil change, timing belt. I just started saying random
things parts. That were like, this has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but you know.
Yeah.
So, if you're going to advocate for someone, you need to actually go to a source to where the advocation is going to be successful.
Yeah. It's interesting. So when you have the life of Asawara, mm-hmm. like that is a complete opposite of who he was. Like, yeah. So he's about accumulation of power and about authority and about pride and all these different things that his money, his wealth, his status have kind of given
Absolutely.
Him. Yeah. And he actually stopped, like in some ways, Darius was better about this, but he was an advocate mm-hmm. of actually bringing people together.
Yeah.
Right. About actually finding ways to work together. I don't like a lot of his stuff ended out poorly,
yeah.
but like that was Very the goal poorly. In what he was trying to do. Whereas Asawara, as almost every decision he keeps making, does more to divide people.
Yep.
Right? He kills off Vashti, who's likely a political, mm-hmm. you know, ally. He marries Esther, who's an unknown, right? And then he elevates Haman, who wants to eradicate an entire people. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not actually advocating for the people under his rule. He's just kind of going with the path of least resistance and what's going to bring the most power for himself. Mm-hmm. That's definitely not what you want in advocacy.
No.
Right, and so there's this idea we have to be careful. Asawara teaches us a lot about not being impatient, mm-hmm. about learning how to walk in humility, not mm-hmm. to let pride and power control us, about how to advocate for those and pursue justice for people around the world, mm-hmm. but to do it in such a way that we bring kingdom to earth, not mm-hmm. our perspective.
Yeah, Asawara is a great example of what not to do.
Yeah,
if you want to live those three things out.
Yeah.
Right.
There are figures in history that teach you what to do because mm-hmm. of the good things that they do.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other figures that teach you what to do because you're like, well, don't do that.
So we're both you and I are, we have older siblings,
mm-hmm.
right? I can't
Much listen. Older in my case. My brother's not going to listen to this, but I want to say it anyways.
I'm sure in your case, my case though, like I had the opportunity to look at how my siblings behaved and see the consequences they got from my parents
mm-hmm.
and to kind of weigh out in my head like, oh, that might not be a good idea. Or, oh, they got praise for that. That probably is a good idea. Now, did I follow through with that? That's another question.
I was to say, I got away with everything according to them because I was the baby.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, right. So point being is we can do that with history too. You can look at people and be like, wow, they did everything wrong. And it's like, good. Note that.
Yeah.
Don't do that. Right. You can look at people and be like, man, they did a lot of good. Okay, note that. Maybe follow their example.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Why was it good? Why was it bad?
Yeah.
How do those apply to our modern context? That's Absolutely. What it happens with reading literature yeah. in its context. It helps yep. you actually understand, like, what does this actually have for me?
Yep.
Like, in my context.
Yep.
So, that's going to be Kings and Kingdoms. King Asawara's. We only butchered it like 80,000 times.
Ahasuerus. I don't know
really,
why it sounds. I don't. It comes out with an accent every time. We got two more episodes that are going to be coming up. Yeah. We're going to be talking about Herod the Great.
Yeah,
it's misleading. And Caesar Augustus.
Yeah, what I'm going to tell you about Herod the Great is that any person who puts the Great at the end of their name usually wasn't that great.
Uh-huh.
So we also will tell you about Spencer the Great. No, just kidding.
I want you to know I did not put that at the end of my name. Ben did.
Yeah. All right, until next time. And that's a wrap for today's episode of Love and Context. We hope you enjoyed this engaging conversation and gained valuable insights into the powerful message of love within the Bible.
We'd love to hear from you and continue the conversation. Connect with us by sending us your questions, thoughts, and suggestions to loveandcontext@gmail.com. We greatly appreciate your feedback and ideas for future episodes.
Stay connected with us on social media for updates, behind-the-scenes content, and additional resources. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and Facebook at Love and Context. Don't forget to hit that follow button to stay up to date with the latest episodes and join our growing community.
Thank you for being part of the Love and Context family. Remember, love is at the heart of it all. Until next time, keep seeking wisdom, embracing love, and living out your faith in the context of today's world.